Hello and welcome to the Etonicast. As always, I'm Alex Roy, here with my trusty co-host, Ed Niedermeyer.
Hey.
And the brilliant Kirsten Korosek.
Hello.
And we're here at the headquarters of the Human Driving Association, which is a half-serious organization, but we're here with a very serious person. We're here with Brian Selesky, the CEO of Argo AI, which very famously Ford made a very major investment in last year. And we're here to talk about Brian and the future of self-driving vehicles and Argo. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So why don't we start off with a little bit about yourself, the history of Argo, and how you came to be the CEO of Argo AI.
That is a lot that you just packed in. So, Brian, feel free to, you know.
Yeah, so I started out in the whole robotics thing at Carnegie Mellon and worked with some really, really wonderful people in the early 2000s, people who have gone on to build companies and do all kinds of things from toy robots to mining robots to self-driving cars and so on. When I started there, there wasn't a ton of funding in this field. A lot of it was government funded. It was early research. And I know a lot of us, we had a lot of fun and we kind of asked ourselves, boy, are we going to ever make a lot of money doing this? We loved the work and we knew that even aside from the money, this was going to eventually turn into some, you know, really important life-saving and world-changing things. And I think we were all kind of latched on to that and wanted to see it through. And really the inflection point for me in my career and probably a lot of others was when we won the third installment of the series of robot races that DARPA funded. And so in 2007, there was a race called the Urban Challenge, which is a robot race that happened out in Victorville, California. Myself and Chris Urmson and Dave Ferguson and so many other really great people were huge contributors to this effort. And really in 18 months, we went from a concept to a winning entry in that race. GM was a sponsor, Caterpillar, Continental, they were sponsors, and so many others. And they were just really wonderful supporters of our cause. But I know that they went into it wondering, you know, what's really going to come out of this? I remember in November 2007 on when we went into the qualifying events and then the competition, we were not just surprised by, I think, our own performance, but by the whole field of competition. It was like really incredible going through that whole moment. And I think it was the beginning, at least, of sort of waking up the automotive industry and so many others of what, just how far along this technology had come.
I have to ask, the DARPA Urban Challenge was obviously different from the DARPA Challenge, the one out in the desert everybody's always referencing. So what were the challenges to the Urban Challenge that were different? What was the ecosystem you were fighting in?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the previous races were very much kind of off-road. You know, you had to follow waypoints and there wasn't a lot of robot interaction. There wasn't a lot of like following the rules of the road necessarily. The Urban Challenge is what brought into the fact that you had to basically follow the rules in the DMV, you know, handbook, for example, so stay within the lanes, obey intersection precedents. You had to be able to park and perform maneuvers legally. But then the other really exciting thing was there was robot-robot interaction through that whole event where robots were responding to one another in sometimes odd and strange ways, which was fun to watch play out. But it was a very dynamic kind of set of situations we had to handle, whereas the previous races didn't have other traffic.
Just so I'm clear, in the previous race out in the desert, because there was the only, I guess, bar metric of success was crossing the line, right?
That's right. All right. Well, but there was a couple other things, but that's basically.
So was it?
I mean, you had to hit the waypoints along the way and then finish. So the best time won.
Was having like a rule structure, like a DMV handbook, that make it easier because there was structure around the challenge, more structure around the challenge?
No, I mean, it certainly made it very clear what a proper behaving robot looks like, and sort of that definitely set the bar as to what we had to do. In some ways, that clarity is helpful, but in other ways, I mean, it's super challenging because now we had to detect and track vehicles all around us. We had to respond to other vehicle maneuvers in a safe, in sort of normal way. We were judged not just on the best time, but on how safe the vehicle was, right? So DARPA had their sort of, you know, mock traffic cops out on the course, and they would you know, build up the list of citations that would, at the end of the day, penalize your time.
What was the sort of technological breakthrough that had happened sort of by the Grand Challenge that sort of made the results so much more impressive?
Yeah, I think when you saw the vehicle operate in such human-like ways and responding to one another in human-like ways, it was the first time we had seen an entire field of competition that had never met or seen one another all show up on this one day for this sort of magical event to unfold. And there wasn't really any crazy carnage or anything to speak of on this test course. Like, it was like everyday traffic. It was incredible just to sort of see that emergent thing occur. It was super fun.
So describe how you got from there to sort of where you are now.
Yeah. So, that was kind of a big point where we all woke up and said, wow, this is really a thing and this is going to change the world. And Google was at that race and took a real close attention to it and said, hey, this is really cool. You know, Larry always wanted to do a self-driving car thing ever since he was a kid. Just thought that would be really neat and would have a great impact on the world. And so I give them a lot of credit for having the foresight to go create this program in the 2009 timeframe. They brought Chris Urmson over. I finished up some work at CMU and eventually joined the team as well. You know, they were one of the first companies to figure out how to safely test self-driving cars on public roads and use that data to then build up experience and build up a core set of IP that ultimately becomes sort of this really neat self-driving system. And then from there, you know, I think the industry started to really mature and a lot of folks started to have an interest in the benefits of this technology. And eventually ended up in late 2016. Left Google, wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and eventually decided to start up Argo. And the whole idea behind Argo was, let's create a company with the intention that we would pull in OEM investment, so vehicle manufacturer investment, and help power them to getting to market and making their mobility strategies successful by us providing the hardware and software that automates a vehicle.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have to interrupt for a second because you're kind of underselling yourself a bit. You were at Google, Director of Hardware Development and Self-Driving Cars for 3 years prior to them changing the name to Waymo.
Yeah.
So that's
before it became Waymo.
And so you stayed over there while a lot of other guys were kind of seeking popularity and working on it until quite late.
Brian, didn't you also work prior to working with Google? Didn't you, with your work over at CMU, weren't you doing stuff with Caterpillar as well?
Yep. We also worked on the autonomous mining system for Caterpillar that's now operating in mines in Australia. That's been a huge success.
What fascinates me a little bit, and it's a little bit of a head scratcher, is when we talk about the race to, you know, this race and everyone's going to be soon deploying autonomous vehicles. I mean, Caterpillar has been using autonomous vehicles in their mining operations for some time now, correct?
That's correct. And there's no driver in the vehicle. And they haul production, you know, in production every day. These are vehicles that are like the size of my house. You know, they're many hundred ton vehicles that are pretty inspiring when you see them in person. It's like, wow, how do they make that?
And Caterpillar makes money. So they're profit. I mean, I think people forget that there are applications out there of autonomous vehicles that are occurring and that companies are using, and these are profitable companies. And I understand it's different than giant autonomous vehicles and mining pits than as compared to, let's say, you know, shuttling a human being from point A to point B. But this has been in use for some time, and it seems like that's forgotten, or maybe it's just media that is just learning about this and starting to report about it. They just don't realize that there is more to the story than just what Waymo's doing or what Uber is doing or what Argo AI is doing.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. I mean, you know, the other thing I'll remind people also that a neural net drove, you know, across the country in like the early 90s with some really cool work that, you know, Todd Yoakam and Dean Pomerleau did. So back in Carnegie Mellon. So, I mean, that was called No Hands Across America. You can Google it if you're interested. I mean, it's like super, it's really neat, right? I mean, this whole industry stands on the shoulders of giants who really made some big strides in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of it was government-funded research. Some of it was privately funded research. That know-how we build from, for sure.
All right. So you left Google and then you decided to launch Argo. So how did that happen? Like, how did you get Ford's attention?
Yeah. So after I left and Pete also left Uber, you know, we both went out to dinner and said, hey, you know, what's a strategy that you think works to make self-driving cars happen at scale someday? And we said, we both saw a lot of value in what the large automakers do, and that building a car is not an easy thing to do. It's a capital intensive thing. And that ultimately for there to be compelling user experiences, that we're going to have this purpose-built vehicle that takes a lot of capital in order to build. It doesn't make sense to try to repeat all of that as a startup, in our opinion. Instead, let's find out how to work with the OEMs to really empower their mobility strategy. And in doing so, let's take, you know, we want to be able to get a share of the revenue that gets generated through those businesses. But let's work together. And in doing so, we can create a much more seamless product. We can make sure that it is completely safe, so that we can hand in hand work with their product development organizations to make sure that the way in which our computers are interfacing with the various control systems on the car, make sure that's all done properly. It just seemed to sort of make sense to us. And so when we started talking to some of the OEMs, it really, Ford came across as very aligned in both, you know, mission, as well as, you know, knowing that they wanted to get into this race and they wanted to be able to hire and build up one of the best teams to go after this big opportunity. And so, you know, I said, hey, well, why don't you be one of our first partners and let's do this together.
Now, when you say race, there's been talk recently about, you know, these articles saying, you know, who's winning the race and what winning actually means. Yeah. And so since you came from Caterpillar, you obviously understood.
I didn't work at Caterpillar. Carnegie Mellon is where.
But yeah. But you're obviously familiar with applying technology to specific use cases that allow the seller of the technology and you actually make money, which is very different from many approaches. And so, what was it about Ford and the way they saw it, and what you were trying to do that made you want to go with them? Like, I mean, did you walk in the door saying, "Here are these specific problems or things I'd like to resolve"? And the products I see that we can build.
Yeah, I think part of it was that this is a hard problem and like it's going to take some time to build this and do it right and to do it safely. And I got the sense that the management at Ford understood that was the case. They weren't expecting miracles in 12 months. And that was important to us because we didn't want to feel the pressure to have to deliver on an impossible timeline and either not deliver or, you know, cut corners. And we don't want to cut corners. This is too important of a technology to do something that these vehicles carry people's lives. We need to do this safely. The other big reason was because Bill Ford himself has been out there for a while now, before any of the other automakers, talking about how it's not about necessarily selling more cars, especially in cities. Cities have mobility problems today. We need to figure out how we can address those challenges with new systems, and whether it be, you know, on-demand, you know, ride-hailing type of applications, or how to make goods movement more efficient. We need to figure out how to do that, and let's bring to bear all the advancements that are happening in electrification, in autonomous vehicles, in smart infrastructure in these cities. Let's bring all these threads together to create a new mobility system that'll really, really make transportation in cities safer and more efficient and more accessible for everybody. We were really drawn to that message, and that very much aligned with our mission as well.
All right. Everybody says, what's different about your approach? Does autonomy require electrification?
So let me tell you. Well, we can get to that in a second.
Okay.
Boy, this is fun. All right. So
you're a smart guy. You deserve smart questions.
Absolutely. Let's put that on the stack for a minute. What's different about what we're doing? I think that what's important is that we're looking at not just taking a bunch of technology and bolting it onto a car. We're looking at the overall business equation. In my opinion, there's three things that need to happen to see something happen, to see self-driving cars have a true impact in the communities they operate in. First is there is true technical feasibility that needs to be married up with a business equation. So some miles are more profitable than others. The businesses that are able to identify and learn the different use cases in these cities and realize which ones are more profitable are going to build better businesses. And when they marry that with the feasibility of what the technology can do in the near term versus what can be done 5, 10, 15 years from now, now you can start to build a business that will actually be able to get to market, you know, sooner rather than later.
Sorry to interrupt, but have you figured out what that is yet? What the most profitable miles are?
And then the third piece that's really, really important before I go there is that it has to solve a mobility challenge in the cities today. Every city has unique problems, whether it be a public transit system that's not working as good as it could because maybe there's a last mile problem. Maybe there's a segment of the city that's been sort of fragmented away from the city infrastructure that's there. What I'm saying is we need to find a way to marry all of this stuff together so that we're not just building a great business, but we're also doing good things for the community so that they'll adopt and want to work with us in making this technology work for them. To me, those three things are essential to have a viable business in the near term. And in terms of figuring out, I don't know that anyone has figured it out yet. And that's why it's so important to get out there and get learning cycles and understand what the networks are, what the movement patterns are in cities today, and make sure that we're solving true problems, not just adding more cars to the roadways.
I can sense, because I'm sitting in front of you, that you have a lot more you could say about this and that you're not so impressed with some other approaches.
Wow. That is like, is Brian holding up flashcards to you right now saying that?
No, but I'm a reader of people.
I am giving an impassioned discussion here. That's all it is. I'm passionate about making cities function better. I think too often the conversation is always just on autonomous vehicles and the like specific, you know, technology bits that make them go. To me, we need to talk more broadly about, no, there's a business here and it needs to work for communities. And I'm just passionate about seeing that happen.
You bring up an important point because when I talk to companies and they're like, you know, doing this pitch and it, you know, oftentimes we'll focus on a couple of things, the technical bits, like we're doing this, we're going to accomplish this. And they will talk about the end result of safety, but it is a very narrow statement. So it'll be like, we're going to make it so, you know, folks who normally can't drive right now have access to vehicles. And also it's going to reduce traffic fatalities. But that's not just the entire problem. Because let's say you solve the safety problem, but then it's actually impossible to move around the city. There's other things at play here.
Exactly. Managing curb space. There's managing congestion and flow through the city. And you know, I'm not a believer that taxes are somehow going to solve all of that. In my mind, it's going to be much more about smart infrastructure. This is what plays into the Ford strategy of smart vehicles in a smart world that we really agreed with. This is part of that mission alignment we talked about earlier, where there needs to be a broader network of systems we plug into that can really manage these important issues for folks in these communities to really take to and adopt these new systems.
So does that mean that Argo is talking directly to cities and gathering data on a city level, local level, in order to do R&D?
So Ford and Argo are together going to these cities to really, we're trying to build up a playbook that helps us understand as we go from city to city, what are their challenges? What are they faced with today? What are ways in which we can make small businesses more effective? What are ways in which we can pull together all these threads into a business that truly works for that city? Absolutely.
So, I mean, this is kind of a sea change, right, in terms of how we think about cars, in the sense that, right, cars have typically been sort of a big part of their identity as most people think of them, is like a vehicle, especially in this country, that you just get in and can go anywhere. And it's basically like, you know, to use the SAE's level, sort of like level five, like go anywhere, do anything. Like that's how we think of vehicles. And it seems like part of what you're talking about is sort of a real conceptual shift towards mobility that is tailored more to specific circumstances. Is that kind of like on a broad level, is that kind of accurately reflect how you're thinking about this?
Yeah, I think at a broad level it is. And it comes back to being realistic about what the tech can and can't do and being very careful about which miles in a city, which roads in a city we are able to deploy EVs onto, autonomous vehicles onto. We also can marry that with what can the technology do? And we can hopefully scope the problem in a way that it's tractable. We start to, I think the public generally doesn't believe that out of the 3 trillion miles driven in the US every year, we're going to automate all of that. And just tomorrow, boom, we're going to flip a switch and autonomous vehicles are going to go out there. That's not how it's going to happen. It's going to be a more gradual introduction. And so we want to make sure that gradual introduction is done in the same way and plugs into a business model that really works.
What I love about this entire topic is that there's so many angles to it, right? I mean, there's the vehicles themselves, there's the technology, there's the locations, there's the scenarios, there's the specific problems you're solving, there's making the money. Each one of these is like a really fascinating problem. And when you put them all together, obviously, it's like this complex of amazingly challenging and fascinating problems. How do you, as someone who is like the head of you know, an autonomous drive sort of outfit, on a day-to-day basis, how do you balance these different challenges? How do you, like, what does a typical day look like for you? Do you spend a whole day focusing on one aspect of this? Do you balance these different things throughout the day?
I think what Ed wants to know is if you sleep and if you work 20 hours a day.
Yeah. I don't sleep as much as I probably do. it is that challenge that gets me and, you know, 300 people up every morning at Argo to figure out how to make this thing work. And
how many of those people are working on technical R&D versus like policy research and like on the ground, like and gathering data? And I don't mean like car level data.
Yeah, no,
I mean city level data, like yeah. Sim City.
I love SimCity. So the vast majority of the folks at Argo are focused on building a driving system. And the majority of that number I spoke about is really engineers building the core product. And then we work back with the city solutions team and smart mobility teams at Ford that are looking at the city part of the equation. What we do is we work hand in hand so that those city groups understand what the technology can and can't do now and 5 years and 10 years from now, and we build out this roadmap. And we're really constructing that playbook together.
Brian, when we spoke last year, it was almost a year ago now, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, just finding the right people and sort of the talent difficulties finding folks. And since then, we've had people on our show who've talked about really, I think of AJ over Speak With Me, who really laid out like how few people are qualified really to handle a lot of this stuff. You've obviously built out your team since we sat down a year ago, but is it still like the crazy wild west where people are getting, you know, insane offers? It is really hard to get them to leave or to stay, within your company. I mean, or has that kind of settled down? I mean, we were hearing crazy offers that people were getting just to go to a company because there's so few people who are qualified. Has that changed or were you still seeing that in the industry?
I don't know that it was ever really the Wild West. I do know that the people who know how to build the algorithms, whether it be in motion planning, perception, which is like object detection, classification, machine learning, and so on, these people are in very, very, very high demand. We have not had a problem recruiting the right people for the job because I think they were all really drawn to the mission that we're out to solve. They're passionate about the product. They're passionate about making cities function better. And when you show that you have a plan to get there, you've got the right team, and that we can all sort of wake up and sort of learn from one another and work together as a solid team, like, you know, you're going to get there. It becomes a really awesome place to work. That's what we've constructed. And really, the recruiting has only gotten easier because word's gotten out about our culture and about, you know, what we're all trying to do together, and people really buy into it.
Brian, you mentioned, I was listening to your appearance at the City Car of the Future event. I thought it was a really interesting talk. I recommend everyone check that out. But you talked about sort of this relationship between developments in sort of neural net software and then the sort of the hardware, the sort of silicon that runs it. Could you maybe just sort of that challenge of sort of waiting for the sort of the software to develop to a point where maybe then it will unlock sort of hardware challenges and sort of how that fits in with your sort of development strategy?
Sure. Yeah. A really good question was asked in that forum around the power demands of the systems that we put on the cars today. And the power demands are extensive. We put data center grade CPUs and GPUs into these vehicles. There's liquid cooling that's used to cool all those parts. And it's a fairly extensive set of hardware. That hardware consumes power. It's more expensive than we like it to be. The question was, well, for this to be viable, don't you have to eventually get the power down, get the cost down? The answer is that the business model actually does support today the cost of the technology. It does support. But we certainly want to eventually be able to get the cost and power down, because that's important as we scale out. It's important from a fuel efficiency standpoint and so on. So one of the things that will happen is as the software begins to mature and we settle on, hey, this is the approach we're going to use, what we can start to do is offload that software from these very general purpose and power hungry CPUs or GPUs and push that software onto very specific silicon that was built and tailored just to accelerate those algorithms. And when you build a custom chip that is, think of it as a self-driving acceleration chip, you can build those things in a very power efficient way.
And is that some of that work being done? Because again, this is something we don't hear that much about, but you look at other things, right? Whether it's, you know, crypto mining or whatever else, you see this evolution from using sort of general, GPUs or whatever into more specific silicon. So is that happening right now, or is there any more maturity on the software side before this development really starts to happen?
There's definitely a few startup companies out there that we're watching closely that are building the silicon, but they're in very early stages of taping out and doing their own evaluations. I think one of the challenges is that, you know, there's a chance that if you lock down the silicon today, that because of the advancements are in the machine learning side of things that are happening so rapidly, that there's a chance that then it misses the boat and the software progresses to the point where it now can no longer use what the chip makers have sort of locked in on, right?
Right.
There's a bit of a dance that's happening just to follow. Okay, do we know enough about what the I/O and the sort of memory requirements and caching and sort of the different instruction sets need to be? Do we know enough today to be able to lock in that perfect acceleration chip? And I would say, no, I don't think we know exactly just yet today.
Is it purely a sort of power draw efficiency type of thing, or is there more performance that could still be unlocked? Do you need more performance? And is that something that could then be unlocked? Or is this purely just about sort of getting the efficiency and the running cost for these vehicles down?
Software engineer in me says always more performance. There's definitely opportunities to also get, in addition to power savings, to get more performance when you start to really tailor to the software. Absolutely.
So, you know, there are a lot of timelines been thrown out about deploying level 4 vehicles. I hate saying that. You know why. Autonomous vehicles. vehicles that will, with a defined use case, that will work in places where there's a business. Yes. Is that not the mobility plan that this board's talked about, that you're talking about? So the hardware, does the hardware exist today or in the near future to meet the timelines that have been thrown out there? We've heard 2021, 2025.
Yes, we believe the hardware solution exists today. Of course, the hardware today won't allow us to operate in all weather. The hardware today won't necessarily allow us to operate at all speeds. But we are locking in right now what hardware we want to use for 2021. And then we're going to continue to evolve the hardware, just like the software. It's a different timeline with hardware, of course. But we're going to evolve it in order to increase range, increase resolution, all those things that lets us get to higher speeds. All those things that lets us operate in, you know, snowfall and fog and other things in the future.
But you're testing vehicles right now.
Yes, we are.
Where?
We're testing in Miami, Florida. We're testing in Pittsburgh and Dearborn.
The Miami vehicles, I don't recall seeing any spy shots of Argo branded vehicles tooling around. Am I blind?
They're down
blind.
There.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Yeah. There's been stories about that.
Actually, I've even written about it.
Sports bombs guys. I must have missed that one. Yeah. But you know, there's a lot of those things rolling around. Who can tell the difference?
I mean, if you read one of my stories occasionally, you might have read about it, because I think I've written about it.
You know, there's a vehicle wrap on them. You can't miss them.
Maybe I got confused. So here's the thing, though. So I see, you know, there was a lot of press around Ford's investment in Argo. But you've mentioned, and I assume for a long time, that you were just Ford's shop. But according to what you said here today, you talk to other OEMs. So are you a brand agnostic in terms of who you'll work with? You're not a Ford shop. You just made an investment.
That's correct. Yeah, the structure of the business was set up in such a way that we could bring on additional OEM partners or even just investors. And it just all depends on, you know, what makes sense for the business. We want to partner strategically. You know, I'm not a believer in that. We need to bring on 12 or 15 OEMs to be successful. We need whoever we bring on next needs to be, you know, advantageous for the overall business, so that we can grow and expand across the world, right? And that's what we're focused on. Ford is interested in the same thing. You know, we're completely aligned in that regard.
Are you going to just focus on the partnership, though, relationship with Ford first, kind of get that and that we would see maybe working with another OEM post 2021? Or do you feel like you could do that in concert with each other, like multiple partners at the same time?
No, we definitely can do it in concert, and we're building the business in a way that will support that. But Ford is our focus. I mean, they were our first investor, our first partner. We're furthest along with them now. We've made huge progress over this last year and change. And, you know, we're excited about supporting them in their 2021 launch. We would never do anything that would compromise that. But there's also going to be new partnering opportunities, and, you know, we're going to be opportunistic and go after them.
We had Jim Farley and Sharif Marakbi on, and they had a really great perspective on sort of the business side of this. And as you mentioned also, you know, utilization is a really important part of making the economics of autonomous vehicle deployments work. I'm just curious, like, how does that affect what you do? Are you actually working on the software that actually sort of manages the actual utilization of these vehicles? Or is that something that you're partnering with Ford on? Or how does maximizing utilization sort of play into what Argo does?
Right. So utilization is a really important piece to the overall business, because every minute an element of the fleet isn't on the road making money is a minute that's a lost opportunity, right? So Argo's piece in that is making sure that the self-driving system won't fail and has, you know, incredible uptime, right? That's really, really important. There's other aspects to it, which is the fleet management in terms of being able to clean and maintain and refuel, recharge these vehicles. You know, that's something that the Ford team is responsible for making sure gets done very, very efficiently. So we sort of divide it up, but I don't think it's one or the other. I really think we all have our piece in making the utilization equation work.
All right. Well, we are running out of time here, unfortunately. I certainly would love to keep this going, but you have your utilization concerns.
Way to tie it together, Ed. I like that.
This is why I make the big bucks. Do we have any like sort of last minute questions that we want to get in?
Do you see Waymo as a competitor? Do you have any competitors?
You know, it's
define competition.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a great question. It's interesting because as you were talking, I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I know who our competition is, because when we go back to those three dimensions about which miles are you automating, like doing good for the community, what can the technology do? I mean, I don't actually know how the whole field is tuning those knobs. Mm-hmm. And this is what the beauty of it is. And this is where the whole race back to the race to win thing is a bit of a fallacy. I believe in the free market system we have today, everybody's going to tune those knobs in a slightly different way and end up having different capabilities. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great thing, right? And that's why, at the end of the day, the more people who are in this game for real, I view as a good thing because of all the benefits that I know this audience knows super well. So who is my competition? I guess now you've just taught me that I don't actually know.
I keep thinking that, you know, whenever I'm talking to companies in the sector, they say, like George Hotz, we just do lane keeping, you know? Right. And then you go to someone else, they'll say, we do a full stack. But then someone else like yourself will come along and say, well, we're doing the stack, but we're also doing use cases around it, business cases around it, and trying to solve the interlocking pieces. Yeah. So your competition is whoever sees it that way. Yeah. And that narrows it down.
Yep.
You know, when you were talking earlier about, you know, how it's going to require, you know, certain infrastructure and working with cities and things like that. And so do you think that when this finally sort of materializes in terms of different companies in this race, do you see one company like per city operating, or do you think that it is even possible for multiple companies in the ride sharing format or shuttle format to work within the same city? Like, I was just thinking that logistically for a city that could be, you know, I don't even know how you would do that. I mean, you'd have to geofence things. Could they all interact within the same area? I mean, that's a whole new challenge. And I'm just wondering from your view of things, how you see that playing out.
You know, I don't know how it's going to play out. That is what's so fascinating about the business part of this whole, you know, universe we're living in right now. I do believe that there will be room for more than one. I think practically speaking, there has to be. There always is. I think any industry eventually matures out that way. But how exactly it works and what the, you know, sort of a musical chairs at the moment between all the different companies playing in the space and who's partnering with whom, that's the fascinating part of this. I don't have the answer, but I think it's well framed for your next episode. I'll listen to you guys debate it.
All right. Well, that seems like a great place to wrap up. Brian, if folks want to sort of follow your work, follow what you're doing, where's a good place for them to do that? Maybe online.
Well, we love to use LinkedIn, and always feel free to go to www.argo.ai.
Brian, thanks so much for coming on. We'd love to talk to you more, of course.
Yeah, this is really fun. Thanks for having me.
Kira, so what do you want?
Yeah, I told you to stop asking them that question because I've got this long project and it depresses me every single time you ask me and I haven't finished it yet.
A book about Selesky. Ed, what are you working on?
Yeah, I have nothing to report, but I'm always open to being distracted on Twitter at Tweetermeyer.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.